Alberta Beef Producers is looking for the next provincial representative to the Canadian Cattle Youth Council. Apply today for the chance to represent Alberta cattle producers on a national and international level. Improve your resume with learning opportunities like board governance and media training. Expand your network in the industry and learn about the many ways you can get involved now and in the future. Nominees must be between the ages of 18 and 40 and an eligible cattle producer in Alberta. Applications close May 17th, 2024. You can learn more by going to abpdaily.com. Today on The Bovine, keep off the grass, or try to, how landowners can support forage growth and recovery post-drought. Did you say pigs in the back 40? The surprising distribution of wild boar on the prairies, and one more role, why an already incredibly busy rancher decided to add ABP delegate to her repertoire. Hello and welcome to The Bovine. I'm your host, Deborah Murphy, and today we have a special guest joining us to introduce the show. Karen Schmidt is ABP's Beef Production and Extension Lead. Hello, Karen.
Hello, Deborah. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us and happy spring to you. Can I say happy spring?
Maybe I think we're getting close.
You've heard what's up on the show today on the introduction, and I thought it an especially appropriate time to have you on because we'll be covering spring grazing and wild boar among two of the three topics. These are also some of your all-time favorite topics, aren't they?
I have many all-time favorite topics, but these definitely rank in the top 20.
Well, top 20 isn't bad. I know you're busy, but do you want to stick around and join me at the end of this show?
Love to. Thanks.
Awesome. Thanks, Karen. Up next, how do your forages look? Many perennial pastures in the province were grazed longer, harder than usual as a result of last year's drought. We'll talk to a master's student who's passionate about all things forages and extension next.
Hi, I'm Kira Haynes, recording from Livestock Gen Tech, and you're listening to ABP's The Bovine.
Well, there's certainly some excitement in the air as we see the snow start to melt, those days warm up, and a lot more calves on the ground. But how are your forages looking? Ahead of the show, I asked Karen Schmidt if she's worried about pastures across the province, and here's what she had to say.
I think it's probably fair to say that a lot of our forage resources took a bit of a beating last year with the drought. And I'm really crossing my fingers that we get a lot of spring moisture, a lot of good regrowth. But I think it's still really important for producers to think about when they're turning their cattle out on grass. And I know that's hard to do with feed supplies being so tight, but for every day you graze too early in the spring, you'll lose 3 days in the fall, and the overgrazing will really damage your forage pastures and native range in the long term.
So just how can you support those forages and perennial pastures? Joining us now is a master's student at the University of Saskatchewan, associate research manager with Northeast Agriculture Research Association, and the voice from Forays into Forages on Twitter. Hello and welcome to the show, David McTaggart.
Hello, Deborah. Thank you very much. It's very nice to be here to join you here today.
It's good to have you on. So some of our listeners may have seen your photo and read some of your story in ABP Magazine, but remind us, where does your interest in forages come from?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up on a small hobby farm just east of Lacombe, Alberta. And growing up there, and along with working with my extended family in their mixed farming operations up near Camrose, I developed my interest in agriculture and kind of how it connects to, I always loved being outside and how it connects to nature. And so that's kind of where it started. And then over time, I was involved in beef 4-H. For 8 years, and so that was a spot where I really got to foster my interest for what direction I could take agriculture in the future once I graduated high school. And so that led me to the University of Saskatchewan, where I did my undergraduate degree in crop science. And if you would have asked me probably in my first year what I was going to do with my degree, I would have told you that I was going to be a plant breeder for one of the big field crops. I wanted to be something like a corn breeder or a canola breeder or something like that. But that changed over time when I took the course that my current master supervisor, Dr. Bill Biligadu, teaches at the U of S. It was arable grassland management. And I started thinking about it. I was like, this whole idea of forages is very cool. And I like the idea of how it connects the animal side and the plant side of agriculture and finds how to these two, sometimes they seem very opposite branches of agriculture can get along and how we can both benefit from that. So that is what led me to do my master's in forage breeding.
I want to talk to you about how to manage forages and perennial stands following a stressor like last year's drought. But can we start with some basics? Can you tell us how perennials prepare to overwinter and what signals their dormancy?
Yeah, you betcha. So first off, we'll take that second part of your question of what starts to signal plants to go into dormancy. And the more I learn about these things, the more I learn how complicated they are. But I think there's two major signals. And the first of those is shortening, we call it photo period is the technical term. So the shortening of the days. So after we get to that other side of the summer solstice and our days start to shorten up, that's the signal for our forage plants that winter is coming and that they need to start preparing. And so I'll use kind of alfalfa as my example there. And so that's when alfalfa starts to put down root reserves. And so what that is that's instead of pumping that energy that they build through photosynthesis into more leaf material, they might still be doing that in part, but they'll also be putting reserves down into their roots. And what that allows them to do is first, when your plants, your perennial forages go into wintertime, they're not dead. And when they're dormant, they're actually still using some of those energy reserves and they need that to live through the wintertime. So that's first off what they use that energy reserve for. And the second is to fuel that first round of spring growth because there's not a lot of leaf material there in the first part of the year. Well, there's none. And so they need to use that then, those energy reserves in their root or in their crowns to then to be able to develop that first spring growth, those stems, those leaves that will be then your harvestable forage later on. And so that's an example or kind of a case study in alfalfa. And, you know, there's variations definitely between forage species, but that's the general idea of what goes on when those plants are prepping for winter.
And in a good year with good growing conditions, you know, we always get the warning you shouldn't graze too close to the time where they're going to go dormant. So what happens when you do graze during that period?
Yeah, you betcha. That's a good question. So when you graze in that critical period, so that is kind of, again, since alfalfa is so researched so well, there's lots of information on that. But again, for that particular species, there's 6 weeks before your first killing frost, I think, is the general rule of thumb. So what instead, that plant's still actively growing. So if you cut it off, so you graze it, that will then result, the plant will want to compensate for that that vegetation that was removed. So it will put energy into regrowing. And that energy then will be moved out of the roots. So then basically you're taking away from the bank account that is used to help that plant overwinter and regrow the following spring. And you're using it for late summer or early fall growth. And that can be okay, but like a bank account, you need to then allow it time to regrow and redevelop, right? So if you're deciding that you want to graze within that critical period of late summer, early fall, then that would be a pasture in a perfect world that you would not graze first thing in the spring because you would want those plants to be able to regrow and redevelop some of those energy reserves before you'd come through and graze it the next year.
And then what about after it's already in dormancy? Can you injure a plant, like whether it's alfalfa or grasses, that has already become dormant?
Yeah, no, and so that's a good question. You can, and I think that partially comes from, like, if you're grazing really intensively and you're injuring those root crowns where that energy is kept, that can negatively impact things. So say, for example, if you had a really high stocking density and you were overwintering your cows on a hay stand you wanted to harvest the next year, and that could be a way that you could damage it. But plants tend to be fairly tough once they're in dormancy and to be grazed, because at that time then, because they're fully dormant, they won't translocate that energy out of their reserves to regrow, because, say, for example, you graze it when it's minus 10 outside and plants won't be wanted. They'll be dormant and they won't be regrowing then. But that, again, I say that there's always exceptions. So the exception there would be if you really beat up the forage stand by having lots of animals on it.
If you graze it to the ground.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so, for example, like right now, is as the frost's coming out of the ground and it's softer, this is a time when you need to be more gentle with your forage stands as well, because you can, this is actually when you can dig up the roots themselves if you're if you've got too much of a too high of a stocking density on it.
And we're also seeing a lot of those plants starting to green up, so tell us a bit about that part of their cycle, about springtime and knowing it's time to grow.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. So I always find it really exciting. And it always amazes me how early plants will start to grow, especially those, those species like crested wheatgrass. You see even right now, they'll start to green up. And that's exciting, especially, in talking about this subject of allowing your pastures time to grow in the spring, especially following a drought. I do understand that in the conditions that we're in, people have to make some compromises based on your feed availability, the business that you run, and the economics. So there's compromises on both sides. But the idea of when we come out of the winter and we want to our forage stands start to grow, that's exciting. That's exciting for us as farmers and ranchers and researchers, and exciting for our cows because they would rather eat green grass. But like I mentioned earlier with that, this is a critical time where you do not want to graze too early, because what that does, the first growth that those plants put out is fueled by those roots and those crown reserves. And so if we graze quite early in the growing season, before there's enough plant material above the ground, that will then deplete the energy reserves that our forage stands have, and they will be weaker when they try to regrow. And so a general rule of thumb that I have heard is, somewhere around that four-leaf stage is when you want to start putting your livestock out to graze on a grass stand. And I think there's slightly different rules if it's mostly legumes, but I can't pull that rule off the top of my head. But with grasses, it's typically around that four-leaf stage.
Now, looking back at last year's drought, what can we expect to see this spring from plants that were stressed by low moisture, high heat, and in some cases overgrazing? Will it take a lot longer for them to get going?
Yeah, no, and that's something... That's definitely a concern. So let's look at, okay, how does drought affect a forage stand? So when we're talking about, so plants need the carbon dioxide from the air, and they need water to help build those carbohydrates that they use as energy. So the carbon dioxide that they get from the air, fairly consistent. Water depends on the year more. So our plants had a lack of water last year because of the high temperatures, low rainfall. And so that then affects how much energy they're able to create and put down into their reserves. So that's one component that is playing not in our favor, that they have good energy reserves coming into the spring. Another factor is overgrazing. So first off, if we overgrazed last year, then we will tend to have, as you graze plants more, they slough off parts of their roots. And so if you graze too frequently and too intensely, Your plants lose roots, and so they don't have as deep a root system, so they can't draw water from as deep. And then if you don't have as much residue going into the winter, you're less likely to catch snow and to shelter those small little tillers that your grasses were laying down for next year. So what that results in then is a weaker forage stand going into the next year. So if those factors, if you think those factors are taking place on your farm or ranch going into the spring, that's when it really is important to let that forage stand rest coming into the spring. And once it starts to grow, as tough as it is with high feed prices, low feed availability, and that's when you need to just let your grass grow. Again, kind of follow that rule of thumb of the four-leaf stage that I mentioned earlier. But if you can, and if your pastures were grazed harder than they normally are, hold back on that would be how we would consider that coming off of the tough growing conditions we had in the 2021 growing season.
You mean to just wait longer, even longer than the four-leaf stage, if possible?
You know, yes, that would be. I think, like, generally, I still think we could follow that rule, but it's always better to be safe than sorry there, too, because even if we think of, as more of that grass starts to grow up, it's during the growing season, plant material also acts as an insulating layer for our soils. And what that helps to do is it helps to cool down the soil surface and keep the water that we have there from evaporating as well. And so to help protect what we have for moisture in our soil bank coming into this growing season.
It's kind of a long-term game. You can't look at it with a lens like, well, it'll come back right away, because it can be injured for a long time before it recovers.
Oh, absolutely. And those conditions, you know, I'm talking to you right now from Lacombe. So we're in the black soil zone or the parkland region of Alberta. And, you know, pastures can be somewhat more forgiving here than if you're in the southeastern portion of the province. Overdrawing on your pasture bank accounts, per se, in these dry conditions, it takes a long time to recover. And it is, when bills need to be paid right now, I do understand it's hard to take the long view on this. But it is critical when it comes to your pasture management in these tough conditions.
I want to ask you one more question about forages, and that is, if we are in that situation where we've felt like we had to take advantage of those forage stands, when we're in a better position again, I hope that's this summer where we see lots of rain. When we're in a better position, what can we do to support their recovery?
Yeah, you betcha. So critical parts of pasture management are how much plant material you harvest. So you graze off. So if we have better conditions, that means our forage production over our entire operation will be higher. And so based on your herd size that you have, if you can afford to leave more plant material behind, that's an important thing. Another component is rest. So like us as people, when we're working really hard, we need rest to be able to function and do our jobs well. Plants are similar. So if we can provide a longer period of time between those grazing periods, that will help your forage stand, because there's activity going on above ground. So it's laying down more of that thatch layer on top, but also it gives your plants time to, listeners won't be able to see this, but I'm making lots of hand gestures right now. They're putting roots down as well. And so if we can have plants with deeper, healthier, more extensive root systems going into through the good times. And so once we hit, it's not if the next drought comes, it's when the next drought comes. Though that will also put our forage stands in better shape to weather future droughts.
You know, I usually keep these interviews to about 15 minutes, and I think we're there. But I wanted to ask you, because I'm sure our listeners are interested. I mentioned forays into forages off the start. It's something you've done on social media to sort of bring people along with you to learn about forages. Is this a project you hope to continue? And if so, where can our listeners go to find those videos?
Yeah, absolutely. So as of right now, as Deborah mentioned, I am currently a master's student and I started in 2020. So I am in the writing and progressively finishing up my master's right now. So I've been doing a little bit more writing than chatting on social media. So I've been a little quiet lately, but it is definitely something that I would like to continue through my work with NARF, or the Northeast Agriculture Research Foundation, coming up. And so, yeah, people can find me on Twitter is where I tend to be most active. And my handle is David MacTagR. So that's MacTagR1. So that's David MacTagR1. Or you can find me on YouTube as well. I have a YouTube channel there that I don't quite post videos as regularly on YouTube, but I do have some information up there for folks. And that can just, you can find me as David McTaggart there.
Is Alberta going to get you back?
I would like, I hope so. I hope so. That's, spending some time in Saskatchewan. I'm currently a board member on the Saskatchewan Forage Council. So it's nice to be around to honor that commitment that I've made. But, no, I think I love my family and the where I grew up too much to stay away forever.
That was David McTaggart, a University of Saskatchewan master's student. Now you're out there checking your spring forages for regrowth, but are you also looking for signs of wildlife damage? According to the Alberta Invasive Species Council, wild boar at large are wreaking havoc on the prairies. Besides being a potential vector of disease, wild boar can cause significant crop damages, abuse livestock, and can even threaten human safety. We'll hear from a Saskatchewan-based researcher next. Our next guest is an associate professor at the University of Saskatchewan with over a decade of experience researching invasive boar. Welcome to the show, Dr. Ryan Brook.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Before we get going, I thought maybe we should talk about wild boar and the name. I was at a meeting recently, and someone said we shouldn't call them wild, we should call them feral. What are your thoughts on how to refer to these species?
Well, I think, I mean, we're all talking essentially about the same thing, so I don't know that it's worth getting too hung up on names. As long as we agree, feral pigs, feral swine, wild boar, wild pigs is what we use, and the reason for that is because not all animals running around outside in the wild are actually wild boar. In fact, it would be very rare to see a pig outside of a fence in Canada that's a true wild boar. When they were brought over to be farmed from Europe, the first thing that experts said is cross them with the domestic pig. You'll get a bigger animal, you'll get a more reproductive animal, and it'll just benefit your herd tremendously. And so that's what most people did. And also, there have been some free-ranging feral domestic pigs that are pink pigs that look, well, literally just walked out of a barn. And we also now have potbellied on the landscape as well. So it is kind of a complex mix of different things. And so there is a chance that some of those pigs that you might see have no wild boar genetics whatsoever. So we like wild pigs, but we're also not going to lose too much sleep over it.
And would you treat any pig that we see in the landscape, should we treat it the same way? And we'll get into that later. But as a layperson, if I see a wild pig, I just report it no matter what it looks like?
Absolutely. If it's outside of a fence and looks like a pig and winks like a pig, then call that in for sure, because there are anything that's out there. We have no native pigs to Canada. So if there's a pig running in the wild, it is by definition invasive and so needs to be addressed, regardless of whether it's a potbelly or even a free roaming pink pig that looks, you know, doesn't look like a wild boar at all. Any of those are potentially a problem and should be reported for sure.
What do those wild boar look like for people who have never seen a picture? Can you sort of describe them?
Well, they certainly look, you know, in terms of shape and they're pigs, right? They're all the same species too, regardless of any of the types I've mentioned. They're all the same species, Suscropha. But wild boar are unique in that, of course, that our domestic pigs were bred from wild boar originally, so they've changed them. But a wild boar most distinctively looks like any pig that you would see in your mind. but it is typically covered with heavy fur. The nose tends to be more drawn out on them, and so they're slightly different looking face, but they're very pig-like, and just the coat color varies a lot, though, because of the different hybrids that we have and different mixes. Most commonly, a wild boar type is sort of a brown-gray color with really thick, heavy fur, but we've also seen many hybrids that have spots. We've seen some that are jet black. We've seen some that are red. So a range of different coat colors is definitely out there.
Can you tell us a bit about their life cycle? They're a rather long-lived species, aren't they?
They do live long. The longest one we know of is 13 years old. That was an animal that was shot in New York State, but it had a Melfort, Saskatchewan ear tag. And so we had to do some following up and realize that it came from a farm near Melfort, Saskatchewan, but was purchased in New York State for a game farm there. It escaped and was living in the wild for multiple years. And so at the end of the day, after it finally was shot, we learned that it was at least 13 years from when it was tagged in Melfort. So they can live quite a while, and their reproductive rate is just off the chain. You know, 6 young per litter, multiple litters per year, and that's 6 young per litter on average. We've seen as many as 16 or 17 piglets in some occasions, multiple litters per year. And they are just what we would call a continuous breeder. So your elk, your deer, your moose, they're having, you know, all of their young in the spring, and that's it. Pigs are continuously breeding throughout the year. And those young ones can be sexually mature at 6, 8, 9 months. They might be closer to a year before they start actually breeding, but they become sexually mature very, very quickly. So that's arguably the most important trait that makes them the most successful invasive large mammal on the planet.
You've mentioned a few locations, and obviously I'm recording from Alberta, so we've already got 3. How widespread is this problem in North America?
All of the occurrences in Canada occupy just over 1 million square kilometers, so that's a huge area. The overwhelming majority of the problem is on the Canadian prairie provinces of Alberta, Saskatchewan, and Manitoba. So we have 60,000 unique occurrences of wild pigs in Canada, and 99.4% are on the prairies. Saskatchewan has over half, and so Saskatchewan and Manitoba have the majority. Alberta is a distant third in terms of overall occurrences of wild pigs. And then after those 3 provinces, there's a smattering in Ontario. BC has had some, so pretty localized. Quebec has a little bit, but so far it is really a prairie province story in terms of the overwhelming majority of the problem.
Is it just a matter of time before Alberta becomes Saskatchewan and we see similar numbers?
Well, there's a great saying I like that the future isn't predicted, it's invented. And so I think to a large part, it depends on what is done or not done. And so I would say we don't know. I think we're in some ways at a crossroads in Alberta about, you know, where does this go? Does it get out of hand and explode and they just continue or not? One of Alberta's challenges also is that not just what Alberta does, but what happens in Saskatchewan, where we do have the overwhelming majority of the problem, more than half of all of the pigs in Canada are in Saskatchewan. And some of those, unfortunately, are stacked along the Alberta border. And pigs don't respect provincial boundaries and move around. So there are some significant challenges, but Alberta's doing a lot of things right. And so I think they're going in the right direction, which is really important. The big burning question is that I get a lot is, can we eradicate them completely? I think Alberta is probably still in that range where it's possible. I think Saskatchewan not. And so that has obviously implications, as I say, for Alberta. But generally, the distribution is relatively limited in Alberta, especially compared to Saskatchewan and even Manitoba. So I think the hope is strong there for us. And again, you know, with a good leadership is so important in this. And we're seeing really good leadership in Ontario.
Hearing your numbers and looking at the map, the distribution maps of Alberta and Saskatchewan, you know, it looks like they're kind of widespread, especially around the middle of our province. I've never seen signs of wild boar, and I'm not sure I know anyone who has. Are they how elusive are they? Could they be in the back 40 right now? Or, like, why is it that there's this discrepancy?
Well, that is the biggest challenge I think we have, is that wild pigs are out of sight, out of mind. They're around, they're widespread, but people are not seeing them. And I get challenged all the time whether they even exist. And for a long time, it sort of felt like studying Bigfoot or something, because nobody really believed they even existed. And part of our challenge was just the, you know, the first year in 2010, we were setting out trail cameras saying, we just need to prove they're out there. And so many people do have them in their area and in the back 40, as you say, and don't know it. And we've had this many times where we've talked to people, you know, where we've been GPS satellite collaring pigs for a long time. And people will say, well, Ryan, come on, I don't know what you're talking about. We don't have any pigs around here. And I said, well, I hate to tell you that, but you have four GPS collared pigs in your back 40 right now. And same with trail cameras. So commonly that we want to set up a trail camera. Oh, you guys, what are you talking about? Yeah, well, guess what? You have a group of nine in your corn right now. And so, yes, it is very much out of sight, out of mind, and people are not seeing them unless people are running trail cameras, which is becoming more common. And that's been a real, really great tool for producers, relatively inexpensive, but then you can see what's actually going on because they are primarily nocturnal, a lot is happening at night. In terms of crop damage, we do believe that a lot of crop damage that's being claimed for elk and other species is actually pigs, but people aren't seeing the pigs, and so they assume it's the one that they're actually seeing. So yeah, I think we have a real, pigs have a bit of an identity problem in Canada in general and in Alberta, that it's hard to get people too worried about it if they've never, ever seen one.
Is there a way to tell apart, you know, the damage from pigs versus elk or deer or any other sort of damage that we're seeing? Or are the things that we need to look for that we're not looking for right now as landowners and citizens?
Certainly, we don't really have any other rooter species. And pigs come in with their nose and they tear the ground up, and you could see this sometimes right after seeding, you'll see these patches where pigs have just stuck their nose in the ground and just pushed along and pulled every seed out of the ground and gobbled it up. And that's a problem. They also get into pasture and cause a lot of rooting damage. And so that torn up ground is really the definitive, well, ultimately having trail cameras and sightings is great, but if you're seeing that kind of damage in terms of torn up ground, that's almost certainly pigs. Less so if they're just getting into hay bales or damaging grain bags and things. The tracks are, there are some guides to identifying the tracks between a deer, an elk, and a wild pig, but they are fairly similar. And if you don't know the detailed differences, it can be easy to assume if you're seeing a lot of elk and white-tailed deer around and you have for, you know, decades, no big surprise that you might not notice the pig sign that well. So that is a challenge as well.
So we've mentioned sort of the damage they can give to land into our harvested crops. Are disease is also a risk? Is that a concern for beef producers?
Disease is a concern. And indeed, you know, it is important to the swine industry, but keep in mind, of course, that a lot of the swine industry is locked behind doors in barns. And, you know, the majority of the large domestic farms are sealed up and they're shower in, shower out, whereas we have these extensive, you know, calving systems where you have animals out on pasture and more now in winter. You know, that the idea of bringing cattle into a tight confined space or closed area right near the home, which I sort of more related to as a kid. Now the animals are more dispersed with bale grazing and swath grazing and these kinds of things, which are fantastic cattle management tools, but unfortunately create opportunities for pigs and leave, you know, bale grazing and swath grazing is a lot of calories laying out there for pigs and will be an attractant. And so that's certainly part of the issue as well. And yes, in terms of actual disease, there are a whole long list of things that we need to think about and be worried about. And they also harass livestock as well. And that's been the most common complaint we've had in Saskatchewan. And that's been going for fully 20 years now, where cattle are being pushed away from their water source and their winter feeding areas and watering areas to the point where animals are so distressed that the producer actually has to move the watering area and feed somewhere else because cattle won't come back. And recently there was a winter before previous, a school bus driver near PA or Prince Albert, Saskatchewan, stopped and filmed with his phone a very large, like 400-pound wild pig chasing some cattle. And so that harassment is probably one of the most common complaints we get. But certainly the potential for disease is there. We just don't have testing of wild pigs, so we don't even really have a sense of what's out there. There's been for reasons I guess I don't understand, there's been a strong reluctance to do any testing of disease in wild pigs. So it is a bit of an unknown so far.
When you see that level of harassment from wildlife, you know, it's easy for producers to want to take things into our own hands, but that's not what's being recommended. In fact, we're hearing not to hunt. Can you tell us about the shift in recommendations from authorities and from experts such as yourself from, yes, please hunt, help us with hunting measures, to now, no, do not do that at all, phone us and report them and we'll take care of it?
Well, and I think that reflects it, that when you work with wild pigs, you sometimes have to throw away everything you knew about other species. And so like many wildlife managers and biologists and others in Canada, you know, you think of, you apply your knowledge of many years of working with elk and white-tailed deer. And of course, elk only have one young per year at most. Twins are almost unheard of. And so using hunting to manage elk can be very, very effective. You can adjust the licensing and you can really manage. And you have to be real careful you don't over-harvest. It might take a decade to recover if an elk population is knocked down. But when you're talking about a female putting out 12 young per year on average, that totally changes the dynamic. Literally 12 times as much as an elk. And survival is very, very high. And so we just have these huge numbers of young being produced. And so people find six and you go out and shoot three and you go, wow, we got three pigs. That's great to come back again. And now there's 20 and they shoot 15 and they just keep saying, well, we're killing more and more pigs. That's a good sign. But it isn't, in the sense that you're, you know, at normally on average, at most, you're seeing about 23% hunter success. So if there is a, what we call a sounder, which is a group of wild pigs, if hunters try and shoot them, they will almost never get them all, and that means that there'll be enough to reproduce. And, you know, as we know, from pregnancy to birth, it's 3 months, 3 weeks, 3 days. So 115 days is all it takes, and you've got another litter on the ground. And so they out-reproduce all of that shooting that gets done to remove them. And so, as we say, you cannot barbecue your way out of a wild pig problem. It just doesn't work because the reproduction is so high and they're so elusive and so smart and often primary nocturnal. And the more they get shot at and chased around or harassed, the more nocturnal they become. And there is no option in Canada to shoot in darkness. And so that's a safety issue. And so they just become impossible. And so, yes, while sport hunting has been a great tool for a lot of wildlife management over the last 100 years, it just simply does not work for pigs. And unfortunately, it makes the problem worse. Shooting at groups breaks them up and it might spread them, you know, 30 miles north and another group 30 miles south. So it spreads them along across the landscape and then makes them that much more elusive and harder to find. So you might find that first group of 12 relatively easily, but the survivors of those that get shot at will be 10 times harder to find.
So we resist the urge to take matters into our own hands and call whatever lines are available to report wild boar or wild pigs. What happens next?
Then it's up to government to talk with their teams that they have that go and dispatch them. Primarily right now in Alberta, it's with ground traps, so large corral-type traps. So you bait the animals, set up cameras, and then once you have animals coming, then you set up these traps. And the ideal goal is what we call whole sounder removal. So you find a sounder of 10 and remove 10. That's really the path forward to success. Anything partial, if you do a whole bunch of work, for example, in our team, if we set up and do a whole bunch of work and you remove 8 out of a group of 10, that would be considered a total failure and a waste of time and resources, that you've effectively accomplished nothing. And so really the only one is to find 10 and remove all 10. And so trapping can work. Other places are trying other things like snaring. Saskatchewan has had ground kill teams with some success. Saskatchewan also announced last week that they're talking about trying using poison. So there are a few tools out there in the toolbox. Then we'll see what else. Our group has demonstrated the Judas pig technique works really well. So you capture a wild pig, put a collar on it, and then follow it, and nothing finds wild pigs better than a wild pig. And so we've shown that technique really, really successful. Hasn't taken off yet for any other provinces so far, but hopefully we'll see that change in the next couple of years, because it is a great tool, and we use helicopter for most of our captures. It's fairly pricey, but it also is very, very effective at finding and removing animals, especially individual males, whereas, you know, these sounder groups are traveling in groups of maybe 4 to 6, as much as 3 dozen animals. And so those are relatively easy to find and deal with. But the lone males, these big males that, you know, 400 plus pound animals out there in the landscape.
I mentioned at the start that you've been on the wild pig file for a while. What got you interested those many years ago?
Well, that's a great question. My previous work had been, I did my PhD working on elk and bovine TB spread to cattle, and born and raised on a farm. And so I'm interested in wildlife, but have this background in agriculture. And so have spent a lot of time working at that interface between livestock and wildlife. And so I got this faculty position at the University of Saskatchewan, which my parents might say is my first real job. And so, and it was funny because I talked to my department head and said, like, what do you want me to work on? And he kind of laughed. He said, well, you're a faculty member. We hired you because we like what you do. Go do what you want to do, and we'll support you. And so we did some work on elk, and we did a major study of moose moving into farmland. But one of the things that I was aware of were these darn wild pigs. And at that time, even in 2010, they were very much out of sight, out of mind, even way more than now. And nobody was mapping them. Nobody knew where they were. Many people argued they didn't even exist. And a few people, or a number, told me, well, if you see one in the wild, it's just an escape. There's no way it's going to survive a nasty Alberta winter. Do you know how cold it gets in January? So, yeah, born and raised in the prairies, absolutely. But in fact, they thrive. And perhaps somewhat ironically, the areas that we have the coldest winters of any parts of any province are exactly where we actually see wild pigs. We don't see that many on the coasts, for example, or, you know, Vancouver Island, which is beautiful, or some of the orchards there that seem like likely habitat. We're not seeing pigs there. They are in the coldest of the cold environments. So they're doing very, very well. And that was intriguing and an important challenge. And they have easily been the hardest species to study in my career. But it's just so important. It became very clear. And one thing that always struck me is I talked to some people from the southern U.S., and they said, Ryan, whatever you do, tell everybody you know, if you see any wild pigs of any kind, stop whatever you're doing. I don't care if you think it's important. It is not. Drop what you're doing and go find and remove those pigs. Unfortunately, that hasn't resonated in Canada through the first decade of work on it. It's been a tough sell, to be honest. But the last 2 years, things have really changed. And certainly this African swine fever disease, which is a global concern for pigs only, it's a pig-only disease, but that has raised a lot of interest, because that would be, you know, very comparable to 2003 when we had one case of BSE and our beef exports were just completely stopped. That would be a very similar and perhaps even more catastrophic impact of African swine fever on domestic pigs. But thankfully, it's only a pig disease. But yeah, we have lots of concerns around impacts. You know, the U.S. pays out about $2.5 billion in losses for just crop damage alone in the continental U.S. So we have a lot at risk to our animals, and risks to the crops they produce, and big time risks to the environment as well, and especially water quality, which of course affects us directly in our own drinking water and for our livestock.
And risk to human safety as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. In terms of, there was a major spinach recall in California because it was covered in salmonella and E. coli from wild pigs going in there at night. And while it's not that common, they can attack humans as well. We've had a couple of close calls and one person in our team that got sliced very badly in the leg. A couple of summer students that were charged. And so we've had definitely close calls. And, 2 years ago in Texas, a woman was standing right in front of her house between her car and her house, and a group of wild pigs killed her. And so we definitely have to recognize that, not only is it an environmental risk, an ag risk, it's a potential human safety risk as well. So we need to be careful.
Well, Ryan, I'm glad that you are working on this and that you had the time to join us today to share some of those insights. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. Great to talk to you.
That was Dr. Ryan Brook, Associate Professor at the University of Saskatchewan. You can find him on Twitter at Ryan K. Brook or Facebook at Wild Pig Research. You can also learn more about wild boar at large in Alberta specifically by going to the Government of Alberta's dedicated website or heading to the Alberta Invasive Species Council's site, abinvasives.ca. Alberta Invasive Species Council is currently raising awareness of wild boar at large through its Squeal on Pigs campaign, so watch for those graphics and share them widely, and I think you get extra points for puns. They just love their pig puns. If you see signs and sightings of wild boar at large or wild pigs in Alberta, you can report them one of four ways: through the EDMAPS app, that's EDDMAPS app, 310 Farm, emailing af.wildboar@gov.ab.ca, or getting in touch with your local municipality. Up next, we'll talk to a delegate who joined us on March 2nd at our annual general meeting. And it's only been a month, but she's experienced so much. So we'll talk to her a bit about that, as well as why she took on another role when she has so many commitments in her community, in her professional life, and with her family. In March, we welcomed some new directors and delegates to the table. Our next guest is one of those new delegates, but you may already know her. She's an active member of the agriculture community as a rancher, community volunteer, Alberta Provincial Coordinator for Verified Beef Production Plus, and Vice Chair of the Results Driven Agriculture Research Board of Directors. Melissa Downing, welcome to the show, and more importantly, welcome to Alberta Beef Producers.
Thanks, Deborah. I am happy to be a part of it.
Before we get into your new role here, can you tell us a bit about your operation? You're in the Northeast Zone, right?
Yes, and we're actually quite on the south end of the Northeast Zone. So we're at Matisko, which is just a hamlet in East Central Alberta. We run a cow-calf operation on primarily native prairie, and our kids are the fifth generation on the farm, so it's been in the family since it was homesteaded.
How are things looking on the native prairie coming into spring? I'm assuming you were part of the widespread drought being in East Central Alberta there.
Yes, we definitely are. It was pretty dry. We did get quite a bit of snow over the winter, but this is the driest we've ever had our corrals for starting calving season, so the snow has pretty much disappeared, and we're hoping for rain in the near future to get things going this spring.
Well, it's clear based, I think, on my introduction alone that you're rather busy, but now you're adding into it calving and your job with VBP Plus, your ranch. You have so many other personal commitments as well. What made you decide to take on a role like this, and why at Alberta Beef Producers?
You know, I've seen a lot of evolution in Alberta Beef Producers the last few years, and I've been kind of involved at a distance, just watching things. And I've really seen a positive movement, but I think there's a real need in the industry right now for people to be involved. And, you know, at the semi-annual meeting for ABP, I was talking, I attended the meetings and I was a little, I guess I would have liked to see a little more engagement from the community, from the beef community. And so I felt that, you know, if not me, then who, and why not get involved? And I do feel like I have, you know, a pretty solid understanding of the industry around the province and some of the challenges that are there and some of the things that we're up against in the future, because I do stay quite connected to producers around the province and different parts of the industry. That would give me a little bit of perspective to bring to the table.
How you mentioned the engagement side of things and hoping to see more. Do you have ideas for how you might get more engagement at the table and more people involved in discussions?
Well, I'd like to see that as ABP delegates. You know, I think that's our role as delegates, is to be that connection point for producers in our zones. So if you are a producer listening to this, get in touch with your local, one of your delegates in your area, and talk to them about the issues that are concerning you or the things that you want to address in the industry. Because I think that's really, we need to be very on the ground, very engaged in local events as delegates, so that we can make those connections and let people know that we're representing them at the table of ABP, and so that we can address things if they want to be heard about something.
You're not only sitting at the ABP table, as I mentioned, you're also on the Canadian Cattlemen's Association board now, and you're only a few weeks in, but you've traveled to Ottawa and back already. How has it been so far kind of acquainting yourself with ABP and CCA and then getting to go on that trip?
Yeah, that was kind of a whirlwind whirlwind planning, because that happened right after the AGM. It was only a few weeks. So that happened very quickly. I mean, it's been great in terms of getting to connect with a lot of the producers across Canada that are, you know, also representatives on CCA. The ABP, as I said, I've had some, you know, I've worked with ABP through Verified Beef Production Plus for quite a few years. I've been engaged with them and I understand a lot of what's going on there. So that was a pretty easy transition. And I mean, the topics that are at CCA, there's a lot of things going on there, and a lot of things being discussed that most producers don't even know are issues that the industry's facing. So that was really interesting to get a good understanding of some of those issues and what's being done about them at the national level to help manage them so that that producers can keep producing beef in a good way.
What are some of those issues that you mentioned that maybe the average producer doesn't know are being talked about at that level?
Well, the CCA has a bunch of committees. So, for example, animal care and environment, domestic ag policy, things like that. And so there's issues related to traceability or transportation guidelines, related to animal care guidelines, environmental policies, and domestic trade or domestic policies. There's just a lot of inner workings, I guess, that often get discussed more at the national level and especially in Ottawa, related to government policies and helping to make sure that we're heard at that table as the government setting direction for the future.
Were there some opportunities for networking as well as the learning you did on kind of those higher issues management pieces?
Yeah, it was a good networking event. We did actually have one reception with, you know, a lot of industry people were invited, but also politicians, senators, MPs, and other government representatives and staff. And so that was a really great opportunity to help make the connection so that when they're setting policies, when they're having these discussions, they can keep in mind our perspective and make sure that that's taken into account. So those relationships that are built at those events are actually very valuable for the industry to make sure that we have a point of contact. So, you know, if they have a question about a particular industry and how it might affect us, that they can come to us and ask for direct input from the industry. And, you know, the CP rail strike was a really recent one that there was a lot of work done, a lot of conversations between government and industry reps to make sure that could be resolved as quickly as it was.
As you move forward in your new roles with ABP and CCA, are there specific challenges and opportunities you're most passionate about and you might bring to the table for discussion?
Well, I mentioned that we have mostly native prairie here. I mean, that's something that I'm quite passionate about, is maintaining grasslands, and not just native prairie, but just grasslands in general. And I mean, we are facing a real pinch when we look at competing with cropland right now. And I mean, new technologies could mean that more grassland gets converted because there's the ability to farm things that couldn't be farmed before. So I do have a passion for that side of things, and the way that it can help tell our story in a positive way as well as producers. So I think that would be one of my key things, is the, you know, the biodiversity in the grasslands and the carbon sequestration, and working towards a way that producers can benefit from all of those services that they offer, the, you know, ecological goods and services that they offer as producers, that could be something that helps them to be more economically sustainable in the long run as well.
Can you paint a bit of a picture of what the grasslands look like in your area for people who haven't been there or believe that it is incredibly flat?
Well, yeah, flat wouldn't be a word I would use to describe the area. I would say rolling terrain. And so we're not the foothills, but we have a lot of undulation, and we're actually on the edge where our ranch is. We're on the edge between grasslands and aspen parkland, and so we have a mix of open, dry, very dry grassland, very 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 sandy soils, but we also have some aspen. Most of it's pretty scrubby aspen because it's limited on nutrients in the soil, and also we have limited rainfall on most years, so somewhat of a prairie desert in this area, which I know you're familiar with, Deborah. But, yeah, it's a unique landscape. We had some surveys done here a couple of years ago, some ecological surveys, and they couldn't believe how many different soil types we have just within our ranch, and different composition, species composition for your grasslands and your aspen parkland and all the different mixes in between.
If you talked a little bit about the different trees and grasses that you have there, and also just the importance of grasslands. And I think one of the key things about when we talk about the importance of grasslands is bringing people who may not really truly understand them or have a good knowledge of them to the farm. If you were to bring someone from the city or from another country even to your farm, what would you be most excited to show them?
You know, it's funny. I'll bring this to when I was coming back from Ottawa. I was on the plane with a lady next to a lady who lives in Ottawa, and she's from there, and she's traveled the world. She's lived in Switzerland and in the States and kind of all over the place. And we got talking about beef production, and I explained to her how we have all this natural grasslands and different species on it. And I told her about these surveys. And so I told her that we have 63 species of bees, like pollinator bees, on our property. And she couldn't wrap her head around that there's that many species of bees. And I mean, that's, there's all kinds of birds and wildlife, and, you know, we have it everywhere here. And I think that's what I would just want to show people is, you know, we've got some wetlands, not very many, I'll say, out here, but we do have a couple. You know, we've got all different wildlife, and that to me is really neat, that we provide all this habitat and have that diversity present.
You've given us kind of a picture of your farm, your ranch, some of your passions, and also what you've been doing the last few weeks with ABP and CCA. What are your next steps, and what are you most looking forward to in your time with us?
Oh, I mean, I look forward to all of it. I'm still getting the hang of things at CCA, still kind of working on that orientation phase. But I mean, I'm really looking forward to being involved in these conversations. And I mean, yes, I've got lots going on, but a lot of it crosses over too. There's a lot of crossover between engagement with some of these different organizations and understanding the issues that are at hand and being able to put perspective in it in different ways. But I mean, like, ultimately I want to help work towards this industry being sustainable long term and being something that our kids can get involved with if they want, right? And that's what makes me, that's what this is, because it's my hobby, right? I don't have hobbies. I do these boards and stuff, and that's my time that I enjoy doing that and being involved with it. But I mean, the biggest reason I enjoy it is because I see the future and I see the potential in the industry and the way that we really have an opportunity to help shape it right now. And I think we need people who are very passionate about the industry and, you know, to help steer that and help get to the point where if our kids or, you know, anyone's kids want to get involved or grandkids get involved in the beef industry, that's something that is, you know, economically viable for them and something they can be proud of because of what we've built up as an industry and, you know, the reputation that beef has.
Well, I sure appreciate you taking the time in your busy schedule to talk to us on the bovine. So thank you very much. And we will for sure catch up at some of the upcoming in-person events.
Yes, I look forward to it now that things are opening up. It's fantastic.
That was Melissa Downing, rancher, Alberta Provincial Coordinator for VBP Plus and Delegate with Alberta Beef Producers. You can follow Melissa on Twitter at Melissa R. Downing. And you can also get in touch with her or any of our delegates by heading to abpdaily.com. Before we end today's show, I just want to invite Karen Schmid back to her mic. Karen, I know at the end of the interview on wild pigs or wild boar at large, I briefly mentioned Squeal on Pigs. Can you give us a bit more background on that initiative?
Squeal on Pigs is an adaptation of a program out of Montana, actually, that is run by the Alberta Invasive Species Council and supported by ABP. And what it really is an awareness campaign to encourage the reporting of wild boar in Alberta so that control measures can be taken and also to support awareness and research efforts.
Now, we are running a little bit over time, but Karen, while you're here, I did want to talk to you about further opportunities for people involved with Alberta beef producers. As you heard in Melissa Downing's interview, she's now on the CCA board of directors, but that's not the only option for delegates. Can you give us a bit of background on what people can do if they're interested in research?
Yes, for sure. What we do in ABP's research funding is all of our decisions are made by producers for producers. And so we're always looking for engaged producers who have particular interests in anything from forage and grasslands to feed efficiency to beef quality and food safety to help evaluate research proposals and provide us with that direction of what research moving forward best addresses our industry priorities and will have a good rate of return on investment for beef producers.
Karen, thanks for joining us to intro and extra the podcast. I know I asked you at the very last minute and you still agreed, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Deborah. This was awesome.
That was Karen Schmid, Beef Production and Extension Lead with Alberta Beef Producers. If you're interested in helping ABP direct our research dollars or want to know more about what you heard from Karen, you can reach her, Karen S. at albertabeef.org, and that's Karen with an I, S. at albertabeef.org. That's all for this episode of The Bovine, the longest one to date. Thank you so much for listening. You can stay tuned to ABP Daily and your favorite podcast apps for our next episode. And hey, have an idea for a future show, a question you'd like us to answer, or do you want to share where you're listening from? We'd love to hear that, and I'd love to share that on the podcast. Get in touch on social by tagging Alberta Beef Producers or email podcasting@albertabeef.org.